So many people honestly think that remembering Christ in December and in the spring constitutes a walk with Christ. They could not be more wrong. Remembering Christ in December and in the spring is good, but walking with Christ is a 24/7, isn't it? Even coming to Jesus in conversion is only the beginning. There are many spiritual miles yet to be traveled before the race is over. And some of you have walked many, many more miles than I have, and I've walked more of those miles than some of you. But there are times of fatigue. There are times of discouragement. I think Paul understood that. That's why in Galatians chapter 6, verse 9, he says, "Be ye not weary in well-doing." I can stand before you here this morning or this afternoon, not with pride, but with honesty, and say, I sometimes get weary in well-doing. And I think you have a choice. You can either agree with me or be dishonest with yourselves, because I think we all do. And I think that's undoubtedly one of the important reasons why we have not only warnings in the Bible, and not only instruction, but we have certain passages that are, I believe, deeply encouraging and inspiring. And I want to look at one of those with you this afternoon. I'm going to be taking my thoughts from Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. "Wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God." The Bible often uses run, running, race as metaphors to describe our Christian lives and our Christian walk. And so we have it here in Hebrews 12 and 1. Have you ever had to run for your life? Now, there may be some here who have. I can honestly have to say I don't think I have ever had to run for my life. Now, I've run because I was scared or afraid, but I don't know that my life, to my knowledge, my life didn't hang in the balance. But I do understand that it is a tremendous, would be, and is to some extent a tremendous motivator. If I could convincingly, and I can't because of the way I've set this up, but if I could convincingly yell fire, and you were all convinced there was a fire in the building, some of you would move faster than you normally move, and others of you would be less gracious and less polite as you stepped on the backs of those as you are leaving the building. That's what fear and angst can do for us. I remember an illustration I once ran across of two gas company men were in a small town, and they were reading the meters. And if you grew up in a small town, and many of you do, the meters were used to be in the back along the alleys. I don't even know if we got alleys anymore, not in new neighborhoods. But these two young men were reading the gas meter, so they parked their truck at one end of the block and went down the alley, and they were reading the gas meters for that block. They got to the end of the block, and obviously they had to go back to their truck. Well, being young men, they decided to make that a little bit of a contest. They decided they would race back to their truck. So these two 20-some-year-old men just started racing as hard as they could back to their truck. About halfway down the block, this 63-year-old woman caught them and took the lead. And they thought, that is amazing. So they stopped, and when they got there and asked her what in the world was going on, she said, "Well, I live at the end of the block, and any time I see two gas men running as fast as they can from my house, I'm out of there." Well, I can understand that. I'd be moving too. Isn't it amazing what emotions can do to us? We can talk about adrenaline and all these other things that affect us, and I believe in those things, but they're generated by emotions. Well, the passage in Hebrews 12, I think, is for me a very emotional passage. As I look at it, maybe a little differently or a little broader than I used to look at it. And I'll share with you my thinking on it. The setting here, or the scene, or the illustration is running a race. And let us run with patience the race that is set before us, the latter part of verse 1. Now, in the first century, they were quite used to races, much like we are, and their races often took place in a coliseum or an amphitheater. And those were not often small. I mean, they would sometimes seat 50, 60,000 people, not that much different than Arrowhead Stadium. And people would come and watch the various sporting events or the races. The early Olympics were something that the Greeks were somewhat familiar with. So this metaphor of the Christian life being a race, Paul uses that metaphor in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, where he's striving for the race lest he be a castaway, was something that's used frequently in the New Testament because the audiences then were familiar with it. Now, I don't know if you're a sports enthusiast. Some of you are, some of you aren't, but you'll still recognize this illustration. There is in sports, and maybe in other activities, but it's most commonly in sports, a term called home court advantage. And it simply means that all things equal, the home team has an advantage. Statistics show that the home team wins 60% of the time. So if you know nothing about the event and choose to gamble on it, which I'm not advocating, and vote for the home or bet on the home team every time, you're going to win 6 out of 10 times. But they've done a lot of thought and research and speculation as to what constitutes the home court advantage. It exists, but why? Well, some have thought, well, the home team gets to sleep in their own bed and they're close to home and don't have to travel, so maybe that's an advantage. Some have speculated that, well, the referees are going to be a little more inclined to be for the home team. That's a possibility, but most people, and I would be one of these, suspect that the reason for this home team advantage is the adrenaline that comes from the cheering crowds for the home team. And athletes will tell you that there's been times they didn't think they could go any harder and they'll hear a roar from the crowd and it's just like it's a boost of adrenaline. Las Vegas seems to buy it. All things equal, a football team is given 3 points advantage. Basketball teams are given 7-point advantages when they are the home team. Now back to Hebrews chapter 12. The race is in a coliseum, and it says, "Wherefore, seeing we are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses," spectators in the stands, if you will, are cheering on the racing people and the component. And that is a burst of enthusiasm, encouragement, and stamina. Racing before an audience, a massive audience, can have a real effect on the ability of the racers or participants or runners to run. Jameson Faust, in his commentary, says about this cloud of witnesses, it's a numberless multitude above us like a crowd being there to support the strenuous efforts of the runner. Albert Barnes says it's a representation that we ought to act as if we are in their sight. Now, who constitutes this cloud of witnesses? Who constitutes the people in the stands? Well, they're deceased. Chapter 12 follows chapter 11, and you understand the chapter breaks weren't given to us until the 1100 ADs, and the verse breaks weren't given to us until the 1500s. That's fine. It helps us find our passages. But the thought here in chapter 12 is immediately after chapter 11, and chapter 11 is the heroes of faith. And one of the things that I think the writer is clearly telling us is that this cloud of witnesses is made up, at least partially, of these men and women that he just referred to in chapter 11. Now think about this for a moment. If that is correct, and I don't know how to interpret this passage in any other context, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, etc., are in the stands of heaven, and they are cheering us on. Let me read this verse again. Seeing we are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us run with patience the race that is set before us. Now, I didn't read the middle part of that verse. We'll get to that shortly. So I believe without a question, the cloud of witnesses contains, at a minimum, these men and women listed in chapter 11. And it seems to me quite probable that it's not just the ones that are named in chapter 11, but all of those who have, in the Bible, been men and women of faith. I find that extremely encouraging that Abraham, Moses, David, you pick the names, are in the stands saying, John, you can do it. And they're cheering us on. I don't find too many commentaries or people that would refute what I just said. I'm sure I could find somebody who would. But I think that's clearly the context. But I want to take it a step further. You don't have to accept this, but I do. So I share it with you. Why would the cloud of witnesses be limited only to the people of faith in the Bible? Why would it be only limited to the people in chapter 11? If Abraham, Isaac, Moses, etc. can see us from the stands and they're departed saints, what about those that maybe we've even known that have left us before we've died? And you fill in the names. I can look at almost every face here and put some names of people, loved ones in the Lord that we have lost. Could it be that they're among the cloud of witnesses also? Could Winford Lee be in the stands? Could Wilford Landis be in the stands? Could Wendell Sparks be in the stands? And you just add as many names as you want. My question is, if Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and these people in chapter 11 can be in the cloud of witnesses, why not other departed saints? And I have no reason to exclude them, so I reach the conclusion that they are probably there. Now, there are objections to what I just said, or there are objections made, and I want to address at least a couple of those. One of them would be, well, if our departed loved ones can see what we're doing, wouldn't some of what we're doing make them sad? Well, that's a legitimate comment. And I can't tell you exactly how this works, but it would seem to me that the Lord has a way of blocking that out, because the preponderance of evidence, in my opinion, that they can observe us is greater than the objections that they can't observe us. And let me give you a couple of reasons. Well, I'll give you four. Four reasons from Scripture that I believe it's quite probable that people that have preceded us in death can see us. At least to some extent. Now, I don't know how much detail. You go back to 1 Samuel chapter 28, you find Paul going to the witch of Endor. And he goes to the witch of Endor, and many of you are familiar with this story, to what? Call up the spirit of Samuel. And I believe he does. I don't think this was common, but in this particular case, the Bible says Samuel appeared. I take the Bible for what it says, and Samuel had been dead. But Samuel seems aware of some of the difficulties Saul had been having. Question, how would Samuel know of the difficulties Saul had been having since Samuel died if he didn't have some awareness of what was going on? I go to Matthew chapter 17, Moses and Elijah at the Transfiguration seem to have some awareness of the ministry and the purpose of Christ being incarnate. How would they know that? A side question that I don't have the answer to is, how did Peter, James, and John know that it was Moses and Elijah when they'd have no idea what Moses and Elijah looked like? There must have been some divine intervention there. When I go to Luke chapter 16, Lazarus and the rich man. Now, we're not told specifically what Lazarus sees, but we are told that the rich man, who wasn't in heaven, was able at least apparently to know that his brothers hadn't repented, because he asked Abraham to send somebody to go help him out. How did he know? Now, he could have just supposed. But probably the most compelling one for me is found in Revelation chapter 6, verses 9 and following, when they open up the fifth seal. And the martyred saints, by definition, dead saints that had been killed for their Christian service, go to the Lord and say, "How long until you avenge our death?" In other words, they didn't feel like the Roman government or the Romans or whoever had killed them had been avenged. And so they asked the Lord, "What's holding you up?" Obviously a paraphrase. God says, "Chill out. I got it under control." But they knew, apparently, something about what was going on. So I asked myself, if those are examples are valid, why are they any different than some of our close, personal, knew them in the flesh, brothers and sisters, might be in this cloud of witnesses that are rooting us on? There certainly is an intensity to this race that the Lord is giving us. And I think one of the great encouraging things for me is this cloud of witnesses. Just think of that. These people caring enough about me and caring enough about you to be rooting us on as we're still running the track. Maybe someday we'll take our seats in the stands with them and root on our children or our grandchildren or our mates left behind or just people we have known. But I want to make another point on this passage, and then we'll maybe come back to this a little bit. In the middle of verse 1, he says, "Let us lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us." There is a difference between a weight and a sin. Not all weights are wrong, but all sins are wrong. And he's not being repetitive. He says, let's lay aside every weight and the sin. Weight and sin are not necessarily synonymous. And let me share with you a little bit of what I understand this to be. We're running this race, he's saying, don't let anything handicap your race. Don't let anything distract you. Now, sin is a distraction in finishing this race. But weights can also be a distraction. I think the devil is perfectly happy to distract us, even with good things. He's just as happy to distract us with good things as he is to distract us with sin. I don't think he cares what distracts me or you. He's only interested in us being distracted. So these weights, to me, is the concept of things that hinder us. It's my understanding in some of the early Olympics or early athletic events, the participants would run nude. Now, obviously, I'm not going to recommend that. I had always thought, and I guess I think I still think, that it was probably so that they were not encumbered by any extra weight. And I'm not a track and field guru, but when I watch the Olympics, they got something on. Some of you would say they're clothed, and some of you would say they're not. But their clothing doesn't weigh very much. Ounces. It's very thin. So I had always thought, and still probably think, that their running in the nude was so they wouldn't be weighted down. Someone suggested to me that they had cheating going on back then, and that was a way to make sure that men and women didn't enter each other's races. I guess that would probably stop that. But I had never quite heard that thought. But when I watch the Olympics, I don't see anybody coming to the starting line wearing boots, coveralls, and a backpack. That would be a hindrance. Now, are boots, coveralls, and a backpack wrong? No. And in some settings, they're perfectly what you want. But not in a race. Paul, writing in Philippians chapter 3, that you'll get to somewhere down the line here in the adult class, talks about pressing on with a focus, not being distracted, single-minded. Anything I can do, one thing I can do, he says. He says in Philippians chapter 3, verse 13, forgetting those things that are behind, not resting on our laurels. Sometimes we have more trouble forgiving ourselves than God does. When that happens, that's a weight. It's a hindrance. It keeps us from running as effectively as we could and we should. Everybody here probably got here in a car or a truck. I think that's probably true. Maybe Kevin. Kevin got here on his shoes. I don't know, but he could. He did. Okay. It's good for you to confess that, Kevin. Most of us got here in a car and a truck. When you leave, and when you get in your car or truck, always remember one thing. Well, remember several things. But remember this. The windshield is larger than the rearview mirror. Why? Because where you're going is far more important than where you've been. Now, I use my mirrors a lot when I'm driving because I like to kind of see what's going on. But where we're going is far more important than where we've been. Paul understood that when he said, I press toward the mark. But it also says, don't become ensnared with sin. Sometimes we have to confront sin in our lives, and we're the only ones that can do it for ourselves. Others may be able to help us, but many times they don't even know about it. It's a mental thing, or it's a private thing. Starting a race does not guarantee one will finish or be rewarded, because we can be disqualified. But what a motivational thing we have working for us in this little passage. Seeing we are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us run with the race with patience. I'm tempted to start putting names of people that I know are important to you, but I'll leave some out and I won't know them all. But let's just take a moment and think of 5, 6, 10 people that are no longer with us that have meant so much to you in your Christian walk. Maybe they were mentors. Maybe they were parents, grandparents. And think of this beautiful imagery that they are in the stands. They're in the cloud of witnesses. And they're saying, Barbara, you can make it. Daryl, you can make it. Donna, you can do this. And they know far greater than we how wonderful and important it is. Now, I don't know how far to take this, and I probably wouldn't give this talk quite this way with every crowd, but I trust your discernment, and you'll throw out the wheat, or keep the wheat and throw out the chaff, if there is any chaff. But I will confess to you, there have been times, my dad died 6 years ago, I think. Is that right? 7? He's dead. And there's times when I'll say, I wonder if he's watching me. And there's been times when that's caused me to stop and pause and give a little extra thought to what I was about to do or not to do. Now, let's say I'm wrong, and he can't see anything, and he's totally oblivious. Still, me wondering if it causes me to stop and think and pause and do a little better, That's a benefit, and I can use all the help I can get. And I'm going to guess you can too. Now, I don't think I'm wrong, or I wouldn't have presented it this way. But if I get to heaven and I find out they don't have any idea what's going on down here, I'll be a happy camper because I'm where I want to be. But it's not necessarily just God that can watch us. And it's not necessarily just God who's rooting for us. That's the main person, obviously, because he and Christ will judge us. But I find this to be terribly motivating in a good way, causing us to pause. I mentioned this morning that we live in a hurried society and we suffer from that disease called hurry sickness. Well, God has a cure for every disease, and his cure for hurry sickness is what's called eternity. Why do we hurry down here? It's because of time. And we run out of time. The day's about over. I got to hurry and get this done. In eternity, that's irrelevant. We can talk to each other one-on-one for as long as we want and still have forever to talk to the next person. We have to prioritize because of time. In heaven, there's no need to prioritize in that sense because time is no longer an issue. When I look at these passages in Hebrews 12, it reminds me that there is interest in our spiritual success far beyond this world. When we begin to feel the world is closing in on us, we maybe feel a little bit down, we need to remember we are not alone any more than Elijah was alone when he thought he was alone. Your success is to be important to me. My success is to be important to you. The Christians sitting in your pew or in your assembly right now are our family. And we need to always remember that. And secondly, we need to remember, I believe, that there are a world of people on the other side of Jordan who are also interested in each one of us. How much they can see is unknown, but I do believe they can see. We know the angels can. Luke chapter 15, verses 7 and 10 talk about when one repents and comes to the Lord, the angels rejoice. How do they do that? Well, they do that by knowing something about what's going on here. I believe we're taught in the story of Lazarus and the rich man that when a saint dies, the angels of God come and carry him to Abraham's or her to Abraham's bosom. How do they know when to come? I think the awareness of what's going on down here may be a little higher than we tend to feel. Now, Paul, or the writer of Hebrews, and I are not implying any kind of physical connection with the dead. I'm not talking about seances where we go and talk to the dead. I don't really mind if people go and talk to the dead, as long as they don't expect the dead to talk to them, because I don't really believe that can happen that way. But we can get great encouragement by pondering that. To think about heroes of faith in chapter 11. To think about our loved ones that have gone on before us. Those that have been wonderful examples, teachers, mentors. Who are rooting with everything they've got for you and I to make it. Some of you probably were athletes in school. I don't know. A group this size, I'm sure that's true. And you can relate to times when you didn't think you could go any further. But yet somebody said just the right thing or caught your eye at just the right moment and you just kept on a trucking. And you finished. Well, that's a wonderful image that I think the writer here is trying to, one of the images he's trying to leave us with here in Hebrews chapter 12. We're also to lay aside our weight, the weights, every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us. The NIV says that so easily entangles us. And we do get so easily entangled, don't we? Moses was entangled with timidity. Timidity is not a sin, but it was going to keep him from serving the Lord. Paul had a thorn in the flesh. Don't know what it was. Paul prayed repeatedly for it to be removed, and then he realized maybe that was a blessing from the Lord that kept him from pride. His thorn in the flesh, be it epilepsy or bad eyesight, those aren't sins. But if it is a weight that keeps us from running the race successfully, it becomes a distraction. Even the heroes of faith in chapter 11 had weights and distractions. Shoot, they had some sins. Some of them were sexually vulnerable. In the Old Testament, I don't know who you'd find more sexually vulnerable than Samson, David. Abraham was a liar. I'm not saying that was the habit of his life, but on more than one occasion, he lied about who his wife was or his relationship to her. And when I read through that, I see a lot of encouragement for you and me. If God can put people with those errors in their lives in the heroes of faith of chapter 11, He can put us there. Why does the Bible call David a man after God's own heart, a man who committed adultery, murdered her husband, had children that killed each other, and raped each other? How in the world do you call a man like that a man after God's own heart? The reason it is true is not that David didn't sin, it's how or what he did with that sin. He repented. Why is Peter a great pillar and Judas a disgrace? I think what Peter did in denying Christ three times was just as bad a sin as what Judas did. The difference was in how they handled it. One went out and wept bitterly, and the other one went out and hung himself. When we perceive we're all alone, we simply aren't. There is a cloud of witnesses that surround us and a history that carries us. The stories of these men and women of faith in the Bible and the men and women of faith that you and I have known that have preceded us to the grave are full of prayers, but they're full of encouragements to us. Throwing off the barriers of fear and the shirking back, the quitting from the race and life's challenges. If they made it, so can you. That doesn't mean we will. That's our choice. We have to make those decisions. But I believe with all I understand of this passage and other passages that the heavenly arena is full of people cheering us on. We may not hear them except through the Bible. That doesn't mean their rooting is any less intense. And that makes death such a different thing, doesn't it? It makes it simply a temporary separation and not a permanent extinguishing of our get-togethers. We're going to close our thoughts this afternoon and extend the gospel invitation. Remember, I believe the halls of heaven are shouting out, you can make it. You can make it. And come sit in the stands with us someday. What a wonderful feeling that would be if when we're taken to Abraham's bosom, we go up into the stands and we take our seat beside Abraham. Or Paul, or Wilford, or Winford, or Wendell. You put in the name. You don't think they wouldn't put their arm around you, give you a hug, and say, good to see you. We're going to have a closing song that Paul has selected for us. In order for all of this to happen, though, we got to be in the race, don't we? We got to get on the track. or get back on the track, whichever the case may be. If we can help anybody in any way, we invite you to come as we stand and as we sing.